whereupon the king decided to accept, informing Grand Maester Picel and the small council that he meant to settle this matter himself and bring the defiant Darklyn to heel. Against Lord Tywin's advice, the king travelled to Duskendale with a small escort led by Sir Gawain Gaunt of the King's Guard. The invitation proved to be a trap, however, and one that the Targaryen king walked into blindly. He was seized with his escort, and some of the men, most notably Sir Gawain, were killed while attempting to defend their king. The immediate response to the news from Duskendale was shock, then outrage. There were those who urged a sudden assault upon the town to free the king and punish the rebels for this enormity. But Duskendale was surrounded by strong walls, and the Dun Fort, the ancient seat of House Darklyn, which overlooked the harbour, was even more formidable. Taking it by storm would be no easy task. Lord Tywin thus sent out riders and ravens, gathering forces while commanding the Darklyns to give up the king. Lord Dennis instead sent word that if any attempt was made to break his walls, he would put his grace to death. Some in the small council questioned this, declaring that no son of Westeros would ever dare commit such a heinous crime. But Lord Tywin would not chance it. Instead, with a sizable host, he moved to surround Duskendale, blockading it by land and by sea. With a royal host massed outside of his walls and his supply chain cut off, Lord Darklyn's determination began to falter. He made several efforts to parley, but Lord Tywin refused to hear him, instead repeating his demand for the complete and unconditional surrender of the town and castle and the release of the king. The defiance lasted for half a year. Within the walls of Duskendale, the mood soon began to sour as the stores and larders ran dry. Yet huddled within the ancient Dun Fort, Lord Dennis was convinced that it was only a matter of time before Lord Tywin would weaken and offer better terms. Those who knew the resolve of Tywin Lannister knew better. Instead, the hand's heart grew harder, and he sent Duskendale's lord one final demand for surrender. Should he refuse again, Lord Tywin promised he would take the town by storm and put every man, woman, and child within to the sword. The tale oft told that Lord Tywin sent his bard to deliver the ultimatum and commanded him to sing The Rains of Castamere for Lord Dennis and the Lace Serpent is a colourful detail that is, alas, unsupported by the records. Most of the small council were with the hand outside Duskendale at this juncture, and several of them argued against Lord Tywin's plan on the grounds that such an attack would almost certainly goad Lord Darklyn into putting King Aerys to death. "He may or he may not," Tywin Lannister reportedly replied. "But if he does, we have a better king right here," whereupon he raised a hand to indicate Prince Rhaegar. Scholars have debated ever since as to Lord Tywin's intent. Did he believe Lord Darklyn would back down? Or was he, in truth, willing and perhaps even eager to see Aerys die so that Prince Rhaegar might take the Iron Throne? None will ever know for certain, thanks to the courage of Sir Barristan Selmy of the King's Guard. Sir Barristan offered to enter the town in secret, find his way to the Dun Fort, and spirit the king to safety. Selmy had been known as Barristan the Bold since his youth, but this was a boldness that Tywin Lannister felt bordered on madness. Yet such was his respect for the prowess and courage of Sir Barristan that he gave him a day to attempt his plan before storming Duskendale. The songs of Sir Barristan's daring rescue of the king are many, and for a rarity, the singers hardly had to embroider it. Sir Barristan did indeed scale the walls unseen in the dark of the night, using nothing but his bare hands, and he did disguise himself as a hooded beggar as he made his way to the Dun Fort. It is true as well that he managed to scale the walls of the Dun Fort in turn, killing a guard on the wall walk before he could raise the alarm. Then, by stealth and courage, he found his way to the dungeon where the king was being kept. By the time he had Aerys Targaryen out of the dungeon, however, the king's absence had been noted, and the hue and cry went up. And then the true breadth of Ser Barristan's heroism was revealed, for he stood and fought rather than surrender himself or his king. And not only did he fight, but he struck first, taking Lord Darkland's good brother and master-at-arms, Sir Simon Hollard, and a pair of guards unawares, slaying them all, and so avenging the death of his sworn brother, Sir Gawain Gaunt, of the King's Guard, who had been killed at Hollard's hand. He hurried with the king to the stables, fighting his way through those who tried to intervene, and the two were able to ride out of Dunfort before the castle's gates could be closed. Then there was a wild ride through the streets of Duskendale, while horns and trumpets sounded the alarm, and the race up to the walls as Lord Tywin's archers attempted to clear it of defenders. With the king escaped and safe, there was nothing left for Lord Darkwyn save surrender. But it is doubtful he knew the terrible revenge that the king intended. When Darkland and his family were presented to him in chains, Aerys demanded their deaths, and not only Darkland's immediate kin, but his uncles and aunts, and even distant kinsmen in Duskendale. Even his good kin, the Hollards, were attainted and destroyed. Only Sir Simon's young nephew, Duntus Hollard, was spared, and only then because Sir Barristan begged that mercy as a boon, and the king he had saved could not refuse him. As to Lady Serala, hers was a crueler death. Aerys had the lace serpent's tongue and her womanly parts torn out before she was burned alive. Yet her enemies say that she should have suffered more and worse for the ruin she brought down upon the town. Captivity at Duskendale had shattered whatever sanity had remained to Aerys the Second Targaryen. From that day forth, the king's madness reigned unchecked, growing worse with every passing year. The Darklands had dared lay hands upon his person, shoving him roughly, stripping him of his royal raiment, even daring to strike him. After his release, King Aerys would no longer allow himself to be touched even by his own servants. Uncut and unwashed, his hair grew ever longer and more tangled, whilst his fingernails lengthened and thickened into grotesque yellow talons. He forbade any blade in his presence save for the swords carried by the knights of his king's guard, sworn to protect him. His judgments became ever harsher and crueler. Once safely returned to King's Landing, his grace refused to leave the Red Keep for any cause, and remained a virtual prisoner in his own castle for the next 4 years, during which time he grew ever more wary of those around him, Tywin Lannister in particular. His suspicions extended even to his own son and heir. Prince Rhaegar, he was convinced, had conspired with Tywin Lannister to have him slain at Duskendale. They had planned to storm the town walls so that Lord Darklyn would put him to death, opening the way for Rhaegar to mount the Iron Throne and marry Lord Tywin's daughter. Determined to prevent that from happening, King Aerys turned to another friend of his childhood, summoning Stefan Baratheon from Storm's End and naming him to the small council. In 278 AC, the king sent Lord Stefan across the narrow sea on a mission to Old Volantis to seek a suitable bride for Prince Rhaegar, a maid of noble birth from an old Valyrian bloodline. That his grace entrusted this task to the Lord of Storm's End rather than his hand or Rhaegar himself speaks volumes. The rumours were rife that Aerys meant to make Lord Stefan his new hand, upon the successful completion of this mission, that Tywin Lannister was about to be removed from office, arrested, and tried for high treason. And there was many a lord who took delight in that prospect. The guards had other notions, however. Stefan Baratheon's mission ended in failure, and on his return from Volantis, his ship foundered and sank in Shipbreaker Bay, within sight of Storm's End. Lord Stefan and his wife were both drowned, as their two elder sons watched from the castle walls. When word of their deaths reached King's Landing, King Aerys flew into a rage and told Grand Maester Pycelle that Tywin Lannister had somehow divined his royal intentions and arranged for Lord Baratheon's murder. "If I dismiss him as Hand, he will kill me too," the king told the Grand Maester. In the years that followed, the king's madness deepened. Though Tywin Lannister continued as Hand, Aerys no longer met with him, save in the presence of all seven King's Guard. Convinced that the small folk and lords were plotting against his life, and fearing that even Queen Rhaella and Prince Rhaegar might be part of these plots, he reached across the narrow sea to Pentos, and imported a eunuch named Varys to serve as his spymaster, reasoning that only a man without friends, family, or ties in Westeros could be relied upon for the truth. The Spider, as he soon became known to the small folk of his realm, used the crown's gold to create a vast web of informers. For the rest of Aerys' reign, he would crouch at the king's side, whispering in his ear. In the wake of Duskendale, the king also began to display signs of an ever-increasing obsession with dragonfire, similar to that which had haunted several of his forebears. Lord Darkton would never have dared defy him if he'd been a dragon rider, Aerys reasoned. His attempts to bring forth dragons from eggs found in the depths of Dragonstone, some so old they had turned to stone, yielded naught, however. Frustrated, Aerys turned to the wisdoms of the ancient guild of alchemists, who knew the secret of producing the volatile jade-green substance known as wildfire, said to be a close cousin to dragon flame. The pyromancers became a regular fixture at his court, as the king's fascination with fire grew. By 280 AC, Aerys II had taken to burning traitors, murderers, and plotters, rather than hanging or beheading them. The king seemed to take great pleasure in these fiery executions, which were presided over by Wisdom Russart, the Grand Master of the Guild of Alchemists. So much so that he granted Russart the title of Lord, and gave him a seat upon the small council. His Grace's growing madness had become unmistakable by that time. From dawn to the wall, men had begun to refer to Aerys II as the Mad King. In King's Landing, he was called King Scab, for the many times he had cut himself upon the Iron Throne. Yet with Varys the Spider and his whisperers listening, it had become very dangerous to voice any of these sentiments aloud. Meanwhile, King Aerys was becoming ever more estranged from his own son and heir. Early in the year 279 AC, Rhaegar Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone, was formally betrothed to Princess Elia Martell, the delicate young sister of Doran Martell, Prince of Dorne. They were wed the following year in a lavish ceremony at the Great Sept of Baelor in King's Landing. But Aerys II did not attend. He told the small council that he feared an attempt upon his life if he left the confines of the Red Keep, even with his King's Guard to protect him. Nor would he allow his younger son, Viserys, to attend his brother's wedding. When Prince Rhaegar and his new wife chose to take up residence on Dragonstone instead of the Red Keep, rumors flew thick and fast across the Seven Kingdoms. Some claimed that the Crown Prince was planning to depose his father and seize the Iron Throne for himself, whilst others said that King Ares meant to disinherit Rhaegar and name Viserys heir in his place. Nor did the birth of King Ares' first grandchild, a girl named Rhaenys, born on Dragonstone in 280 AC, do aught to reconcile father and son. When Prince Rhaegar returned to the Red Keep to present his daughter to his own mother and father, Queen Rhaella embraced the babe warmly, but King Ares refused to touch or hold the child and complained that she smells Dornish. Amidst all this, Lord Tywin Lannister continued to serve as hand of the king. "Lord Tywin looms as large as Casterly Rock," wrote Grand Maester Pycelle, "and no king has ever had so diligent or capable a hand." Seemingly secure in his office after the death of Stephen Baratheon, Lord Tywin even went so far as to bring his beautiful young daughter, Cersei, to court. In 281 AC, however, the aged Kingsguard knight, Sir Harlan Grandison, passed away in his sleep, and the uneasy accord between Ares II and his hand finally snapped, when his grace chose to offer a white cloak to Lord Tywin's eldest son. At 5 and 10, Sir Jaime Lannister was already a knight, an honour he had received from the hand of Sir Arthur Dayne, the Sword of the Morning, whom many considered to be the realm's most chivalrous warrior. Jaime's knighthood had been won during Sir Arthur's campaign against the outlaws known as the Kingswood Brotherhood, and none could doubt his prowess. Sir Jaime was also Lord Tywin's heir, however, and carried all his hopes for the perpetuation of House Lannister, as his lordship's other son was the malformed dwarf, Tyrion. Moreover, the hand had been in the midst of negotiating an advantageous marriage pact for Sir Jaime when the king informed him of his choice. At a stroke, King Ares had deprived Lord Tywin of his chosen heir and made him look foolish and false. Yet Grand Maester Pycelle tells us that when Ares II announced Sir Jaime's appointment from the Iron Throne, his lordship went to one knee and thanked the king for the great honour shown to his house. Then, pleading illness, Lord Tywin asked the king's leave to retire as hand. King Ares was delighted to oblige him. Lord Tywin, accordingly, surrendered his chain of office and retired from court, returning to Casterly Rock with his daughter. The king replaced him as hand with Lord Owen Merryweather, an aged and amiable lickspittle famed for laughing loudest at every jape and witticism uttered by the king, no matter how feeble. Henceforth, his grace told Pycelle, the realm would know for a certainty that the man who wore the crown also ruled the Seven Kingdoms. Ares Targaryen and Tywin Lannister had met as boys, had fought and bled together in the War of the Ninepenny Kings, and had ruled the Seven Kingdoms together for close to 20 years. But in 281 AC, this long partnership, which had proved so fruitful to the realm, came to a bitter end. Shortly thereafter, Lord Walter Wint announced plans for a great tourney to be held at his seat at Harrenhal to celebrate his maiden daughter's name day. King Ares II chose this event for the formal investiture of Sir Jaime Lannister as a knight of the King's Guard, thus setting in motion the events that would end the Mad King's reign and write an end to the long rule of House Targaryen in the Seven Kingdoms. The Fall of the Dragons. The Year of the False Spring. In the annals of Westeros, 281 AC is known as the Year of the False Spring. Winter had held the land in its icy grip for close on 2 years, but now at last the snows were melting, The woods were greening. The days were growing longer. Though the white ravens had not yet flown, there were many even at the citadel of Oldham who believed that winter's end was nigh. As warm winds blew from the south, lords and knights from throughout the Seven Kingdoms made their way toward Harrenhal to compete in Lord Went's great tournament on the shore of the God's Eye, which promised to be the largest and most magnificent competition since the time of Aegon the Unlikely. We know a great deal about that tourney, for the things that transpired beneath the walls of Harrenhal were set down by a score of chroniclers and recorded in many a letter and testament. Yet there is much and more that we shall never know. For even whilst the greatest knights of the Seven Kingdoms vied in the lists, other and more dangerous games were being played in the halls of Black Heron's accursed castle, and the tents and pavilions of the lords assembled. Many tales have grown up around Lord Went's tournament, tales of plots and conspiracies, betrayals and rebellions, infidelities and assignations, secrets and mysteries, almost all of it conjecture. The truth is known only to a few, some of whom have long passed beyond this mortal veil and must forever hold their tongues. In writing of this fateful gathering, therefore, the conscientious scholar must take care to separate fact from fancy, to draw a sharp line between what is known and what is simply suspected, believed, or rumored. This is known. The tourney was first announced by Walter Went, Lord of Harrenhal, late in the year 280 AC, not long after a visit from his younger brother, Sir Oswald Went, a knight of the King's Guard. That this would be an event of unrivaled magnificence was clear from the first, for Lord Went was offering prizes thrice as large as those given at the great Lannisport tourney of 272 AC, hosted by Lord Tywin Lannister in celebration of Aerys II's 10th year upon the Iron Throne. Most took this simply as an attempt by Went to outdo the former hand and demonstrate the wealth and splendour of his house. There were those, however, who believed this no more than a ruse, and Lord Went no more than a cat's paw. His lordship lacked the funds to pay such munificent prizes, they argued. Someone else must surely have stood behind him, someone who did not lack the gold, but preferred to remain in the shadows, whilst allowing the Lord of Harrenhal to claim the glory for hosting this magnificent event. We have no shred of evidence that such a shadow host ever existed, but the notion was widely believed at the time and remains so today. But if indeed there was a shadow, who was he? And why did he choose to keep his role a secret? A dozen names have been put forward over the years, but only one seems truly compelling. Rhaegar Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone. If this tale be believed, 'twas Prince Rhaegar who urged Lord Walter to hold the tourney, using his lordship's brother, Sir Oswald, as a go-between. Rhaegar provided Went with gold sufficient for splendid prizes in order to bring as many lords and knights to Harrenhal as possible. The prince, it is said, had no interest in the tourney as a tourney. His intent was to gather the great lords of the realm together in what amounted to an informal great council, in order to discuss ways and means of dealing with the madness of his father, King Aerys II, possibly by means of a regency or a forced abdication. If indeed this was the purpose behind the tourney, it was a perilous game that Rhaegar Targaryen was playing. Though few doubted that Aerys had taken leave of his senses, many still had good reason to oppose his removal from the Iron Throne. For certain courtiers and counsellors had gained great wealth and power through the king's caprice, and knew that they stood to lose all should Prince Rhaegar come to power. The Mad King could be savagely cruel, as seen most plainly when he burnt those he perceived to be his enemies. But he could also be extravagant, showering men who pleased him with honours, offices, and lands. The Lickspittal lords who surrounded Ares II had gained much and more from the king's madness, and eagerly seized upon any opportunity to speak ill of Prince Rhaegar and inflame the father's suspicions of the son. Chief among the Mad King's supporters were three lords of his small council: Carlton Chelsted, master of coin, Lucerys Valerian, master of ships, and Simon Staunton, master of laws. The eunuch Varys, master of whisperers, and Wisdom Russard, grandmaster of the Guild of Alchemists, also enjoyed the king's trust. Prince Rhaegar's support came from the younger men at court, including Lord John Connington, Sir Miles Mouton of Maidenpool, and Sir Richard Lonmouth. The Dornishmen who had come to court with the Princess Elia were in the prince's confidence as well, particularly Prince Lewin Martell, Elia's uncle and a sworn brother of the King's Guard. But the most formidable of all Rhaegar's friends and allies in King's Landing was surely Sir Arthur Dayne, the Sword of the Morning. To Grand Maester Pycelle and Lord Owen Merryweather, the King's Hand, fell the unenviable task of keeping peace between these factions, even as their rivalry grew ever more venomous. In a letter to the Citadel, Pycelle wrote that the divisions within the Red Keep reminded him uncomfortably of the situation before the Dance of the Dragons a century before, when the enmity between Queen Alicent and Princess Rhaenyra had split the realm in two to grievous cost. A similarly bloody conflict might await the Seven Kingdoms once again, he warned, unless some accord could be reached that would satisfy both Prince Rhaegar's supporters and the king's. Had any whiff of proof come into their hands to show that Prince Rhaegar was conspiring against his father, King Ares' loyalists would most certainly have used it to bring about the prince's downfall. Indeed, certain of the king's men had even gone so far as to suggest that Ares should disinherit his disloyal son and name his younger brother heir to the Iron Throne in his stead. Prince Viserys was but 7 years of age, and his eventual ascension would certainly mean a regency, wherein they themselves would rule as regents. In such a climate, it was scarce surprising that Lord Wendt's great tournament excited much suspicion. Lord Chelsted urged his grace to forbid it, and Lord Staunton went even further, suggesting a prohibition against all tourneys. Such events were widely popular with the commons, however, and when Lord Merryweather warned Ares that forbidding the tournament would only serve to make him even more unpopular, the king chose another course and announced his intention to attend. It would mark the first time that Ares II had left the safety of the Red Keep since the defiance of Duskendale. No doubt his grace reasoned that his enemies would not dare conspire against him under his very nose. Grand Maester Pycelle tells us that Ares hoped that his presence at such a grand event would help him to win back the love of his people. If that was indeed the king's intent, it was a grievous miscalculation. Whilst his attendance made the Harrenhal tourney even grander and more prestigious than it already was, drawing lords and knights from every corner of the realm, many of those who came were shocked and appalled when they saw what had become of their monarch. His long, yellow fingernails, tangled beard, and ropes of unwashed, matted hair made the extent of the king's madness plain to all. Nor was his behaviour that of a sane man, for Ares could go from mirth to melancholy in the blink of an eye, and many of the accounts written of Harrenhal speak of his hysterical laughter, long silences, bouts of weeping, and sudden rages. Above all, King Ares II was suspicious of his own son and heir, Prince Rhaegar, suspicious of his host, Lord Went, suspicious of every lord and knight who had come to Harrenhal to compete, and even more suspicious of those who chose to absent themselves, the most notable of whom was his former hand, Tywin Lannister, Lord of Casterly Rock. At the tourney's opening ceremonies, King Aerys made a great public show of Sir Jaime Lannister's investiture as a sworn brother of his king's guard. The young knight said his vows before the royal pavilion, kneeling on the green grass in his white armour, as half the lords of the realm looked on. When Sir Gerald Hightower raised him up and clasped his white cloak about his shoulders, a roar went up from the crowd, for Sir Jaime was much admired for his courage, gallantry, and prowess with the sword, especially in the Westerlands. Though Tywin Lannister did not himself deign to attend the tourney at Harrenhal, dozens of his lord's bannermen and hundreds of knights were on hand, and they raised a loud and lusty cheer for the newest and youngest sworn brother of the king's guard. The king was pleased. In his madness, we are told, his grace believed that they were cheering for him. Scarce had the thing been done, however, than King Aerys II began to nurse grave doubts about his new protector. The king had seized upon the notion of bringing Sir Jaime into his king's guard as a way of humbling his old friend, Grand Maester Pycelle tells us. Only now, belatedly, did his grace come to the realization that he would henceforth have Lord Tywin's son beside him day and night, with a sword at his side. The thought frightened him so badly that he could hardly eat at that night's feast, Pycelle avows. Accordingly, Aerys II summoned Sir Jaime to attend him, while squatting over his chamber pot, some say, but this ugly detail may have been a later addition to the tale, and commanded him to return to King's Landing to guard and protect Queen Rhaella and Prince Viserys, who had not accompanied his grace to the tourney. The Lord Commander, Sir Gerald Hightower, offered to go in Sir Jaime's stead, but Aerys refused him. For the young knight, who had no doubt hoped to distinguish himself in the tourney, this abrupt exile came as a bitter disappointment. Nonetheless, Sir Jaime remained true to his vows. He set off for the Red Keep at once, and played no further part in the events at Harrenhal, save perhaps in the mind of the Mad King. For 7 days, the finest knights and noblest lords of the Seven Kingdoms contended with lance and sword in the fields beneath the towering walls of Harrenhal. At night, victors and vanquished alike repaired to the castle's cavernous hall of 100 hearths for feasting and celebration. Many songs and stories are told of those days and nights beside the guard's eye. Some are even true. To recount every joust and jape is far outside our purpose here. That task we gladly leave to the singers. Two incidents must not be passed over, however, for they would prove to have grave consequences. The first was the appearance of a mystery knight, a slight young man, in ill-fitting armour, whose device was a carved white weirwood tree, its features twisted in mirth. The Knight of the Laughing Tree, as this challenger was called, unhorsed 3 men in successive tilts, to the delight of the commons. King Aerys II was not a man to take any joy in mysteries, however. His grace became convinced that the tree on the mystery knight's shield was laughing at him, and, with no more proof than that, decided that the mystery knight was Sir Jaime Lannister. His newest king's guard had defied him and returned to the tourney, he told every man who would listen. Furious, he commanded his own knights to defeat the knight of the laughing tree when the joust resumed the next morning, so that he might be unmasked and his perfidy exposed for all to see. but the mystery knight vanished during the night, never to be seen again. This, too, the king took ill, certain that someone close to him had given warning to this traitor who will not show his face. Prince Rhaegar emerged as the ultimate victor at the end of the competition. The crown prince, who did not normally compete in tourneys, surprised all by donning his armor and defeating every foe he faced, including four knights of the king's guard. In the final tilt, he unhorsed Sir Barristan Selmy, generally regarded as the finest lance in all the Seven Kingdoms, to win the champion's laurels. The cheers of the crowd were said to be deafening, but King Aerys did not join them. Far from being proud and pleased by his heir's skill at arms, His Grace saw it as a threat. Lords Chelsted and Staunton inflamed his suspicions further, declaring that Prince Rhaegar had entered the lists to curry favor with the commons, and remind the assembled lords that he was a puissant warrior, a true heir to Aegon the Conqueror. And when the triumphant Prince of Dragonstone named Lyanna Stark, daughter of the Lord of Winterfell, the Queen of Love and Beauty, placing a garland of blue roses in her lap with the tip of his lance, the lickspittle lords gathered around the king declared that further proof of his perfidy. Why would the prince have thus given insult to his own wife, the Princess Ilya Martell of Dorne, who was present, unless it was to help him gain the Iron Throne? The crowning of the Stark girl, who was by all reports a wild and boyish young thing, with none of the Princess Ilya's delicate beauty, could only have been meant to win the allegiance of Winterfell to Prince Rhaegar's cause, Simon Staunton suggested to the king. Yet if this were true, why did Lady Lyanna's brothers seem so distraught at the honour the prince had bestowed upon her? Brandon Stark, the heir to Winterfell, had to be restrained from confronting Rhaegar at what he took as a slight upon his sister's honour, for Lyanna Stark had long been betrothed to Robert Baratheon, Lord of Storm's End. Eddard Stark, Brandon's younger brother and a close friend of Lord Robert, was calmer but no more pleased. As for Robert Baratheon himself, some say he laughed at the prince's gesture, claiming that Rhaegar had done no more than pay Lyanna her due. But those who knew him better say the young lord brooded on the insult, and that his heart hardened toward the Prince of Dragonstone from that day forth. And well it might, for with that simple garland of pale blue roses, Rhaegar Targaryen had begun the dance that would rip the Seven Kingdoms apart, bring about his own death, and thousands more, and put a welcome new king upon the Iron Throne. The false spring of 281 AC lasted less than two terms. As the year drew to a close, winter returned to Westeros with a vengeance. On the last day of the year, snow began to fall upon King's Landing, and a crust of ice formed atop the Blackwater Rush. The snowfall continued off and on for the best part of a fortnight, by which time the Blackwater was hard frozen, and icicles draped the roofs and gutters of every tower in the city. As cold winds hammered the city, King Aerys II turned to his pyromancers, charging them to drive the winter off with their magics. Huge green fires burned along the walls of the Red Keep for a moon's turn. Prince Rhaegar was not in the city to observe them, however, nor could he be found in Dragonstone with Princess Ilya and their young son, Aegon. With the coming of the new year, the Crown Prince had taken to the road with half a dozen of his closest friends and confidants, on a journey that would ultimately lead him back to the Riverlands. Not 10 leagues from Harrenhal, Rhaegar fell upon Lyanna Stark of Winterfell and carried her off, lighting a fire that would consume his house and kin and all those he loved, and half the realm besides. but that tale is too well known to warrant repeating here. Robert's Rebellion. What followed Prince Rhaegar's infamous abduction of Lyanna Stark was the ruin of House Targaryen. The full depth of King Aerys' madness was subsequently revealed in his depraved actions against Lord Stark, his heir, and their supporters after they demanded redress for Rhaegar's wrongs. Instead of granting them fair hearing, King Aerys had them brutally slain, then followed these murders by demanding that Lord Jon Arryn execute his former wards, Robert Baratheon and Eddard Stark. Many now agree that the true start of Robert's rebellion began with Lord Arryn's refusal and his courageous calling of his banners in the defense of justice. Yet not all the Lords of the Vale agreed with Lord Jon's decision, and soon fighting broke out as loyalists to the crown attempted to bring Lord Arryn down. The fighting then spread across the Seven Kingdoms like wildfire, as lords and knights took sides. Many alive today fought in these battles, and so can speak with greater knowledge of them than I, who was not there. I therefore leave it to such men to write the true and detailed history of Robert's Rebellion. Far be it for me to offend those who yet live by presenting an imperfect summary of events or mistakenly praising those who have since proved unworthy. So instead I will look only to the Lord and Knight who ascended the Iron Throne at the end, repairing a realm nearly destroyed by madness. Robert Baratheon proved himself a fearless, indomitable warrior as more and more men flocked to his banner. Robert was the first over the walls at Gulltown, when Lord Grafton raised his banner for Targaryens, and from there he sailed to Storm's End, risking capture by the royal fleet, to call his banners. Not all came willing. Aerys' hand, Lord Merryweather, encouraged certain Storm Lords to rise up against Lord Robert. Yet it was an effort that proved fruitless, following Lord Robert's victories at Summerhall, where he won 3 battles in a single day. His hastily gathered forces defeated Lords Grandison and Catherine in turn, and Robert went on to kill Lord Fell in single combat before taking his famous son Silver Axe captive. More victories were to come for Lord Robert and the Storm Lords as they marched to join forces with Lord Arryn and the Northmen, who supported their cause. Brightly famed is Robert's grand victory at Stony Sept, also called the Battle of the Bells, where he slew the famous Sir Miles Mouton, once Prince Rhaegar's squire, and 5 men besides, and might well have killed the new hand, Lord Cunnington, had the battle brought them together. The victory sealed the entry of the Riverlands into the conflict, following the marriage of Lord Tully's daughters to Lords Arryn and Stark. The royalist forces were left reeling and scattered by such victories, though they did their best to rally. The King's Guard were dispatched to recover the remnant of Lord Conington's force, and Prince Rhaegar returned from the south to take command of the new levies being raised in the Crownlands. And after a partial victory at Ashford, which led to Robert's withdrawal, the Stormlands were left open to Lord Tyrell. Bringing the might of the Reach to bear, the Reach Lords swept away all resistance and settled in to besiege Storm's End. Shortly afterward, the host was joined by Lord Paxter Redwine's mighty fleet from the Arbor, completing the siege by land and sea. That siege wore on until the conclusion of the war. From dawn, in defense of Princess Ilya, 10,000 spears came over the Boneway and marched to King's Landing to bolster the host that Rhaegar was raising. Those who were there at court during this time have recounted that Aerys' behavior was erratic. He was untrusting of any save his King's Guard, and then only imperfectly. for he kept Sir Jaime Lannister close at all hours to serve as a hostage against his father. When Prince Rhaegar at last marched up the King's Road to the Trident, with him were all but one of the King's Guard who had remained in King's Landing. Sir Barristan the Bold, Sir Jonathor Derry, and Prince Lewin of Dorne. Prince Lewin took command of the Dornish troop sent by his nephew, the Prince Doran, but it is said that he did so only after threats from the Mad King, who feared that the Dornish men looked to betray him. Only the young Sir Jaime Lannister remained in King's Landing. Of the famous battle on the Trident, much has been written and said, but all know that the two armies clashed at the crossing that would ever after be called the Ruby Ford, for the scattered rubies on Prince Rhaegar's armor. The opponents were well matched. Rhaegar's forces numbered some 40,000, a tenth part of which were anointed knights, whilst the rebels had somewhat fewer men, but those they possessed were tested in battle, while much of Rhaegar's force was raw and new. The battle at the ford was fierce, and many lives were lost in the fray. Sir Jonathor Derry was cut down in the midst of the conflict, as was Prince Lewin of Dorne, but the most important death was yet to come. The battle screamed about Lord Robert and Prince Rhaegar both, and by the will of the gods, or by chance, or perhaps by design, they met amidst the shallows of the ford. The two knights fought valiantly upon their destriers, according to all accounts, for despite his crimes, Prince Rhaegar was no coward. Lord Robert was wounded by the Dragon Prince in the combat, yet in the end, Baratheon's ferocious strength and his thirst to avenge the shame brought upon his stolen betrothed proved the greater. His war hammer found its mark, and Robert drove the spike through Rhaegar's chest, scattering the costly rubies that blazed upon the prince's breastplate. Some men on both sides stopped fighting at once, leaping instead into the river to recover the precious stones, and a general rout quickly began as the royalists started fleeing the field. Lord Robert's wounds prevented him from taking up the pursuit, so he gave that into the hands of Lord Eddard Stark. But Robert proved his chivalry when he refused to allow the gravely wounded Sir Barristan to be killed. Instead, he sent his own maester to tend the great knight. In such fashion did the future king win the fierce devotion of his friends and allies, for few men were ever so open-handed and merciful as Robert Baratheon. The End. Birds flew and couriers raced to bear word of the victory at the Ruby Ford. When the news reached the Red Keep, it was said that Aerys cursed the Dornish, certain that Lewin had betrayed Rhaegar. He sent his pregnant queen Rhaella and his younger son and new heir Viserys away to Dragonstone, but Princess Ilya was forced to remain in King's Landing with Rhaegar's children, as a hostage against Dorne. Having burned his previous hand, Lord Chelston, alive for bad counsel during the war, Aerys now appointed another to the position, the alchemist Rossart, a man of low birth with little to recommend him but his flames and trickery. Sir Jaime Lannister was meanwhile left in charge of the Red Keep's defences. The walls were manned by knights and watchmen awaiting the enemy. When the first army that arrived flew the line of Casterly Rock, with Lord Tywin at its head, King Aerys anxiously ordered the gates to be opened, thinking that at last his old friend and former hand had come to his rescue, as he had done at the defiance of Duskendale. But Lord Tywin had not come to save the Mad King. This time Lord Tywin's cause was that of the realms, and he was determined to bring an end to the reign that madness had brought low. Once within the walls of the city, his soldiers assaulted the defenders of King's Landing, and blood ran red in the streets. A hand-picked cadre of men raced to the Red Keep to storm its walls and seek out King Aerith so that justice might be done. The Red Keep was soon breached, but in the chaos misfortune soon fell upon Ilya of Dorne and her children, Rhaenys and Aegon. It is tragic that the blood spilled in war may as readily be innocent as it is guilty, and that those who ravished and murdered Princess Ilya escaped justice. It is not known who murdered Princess Rhaenys in her bed, or smashed the infant Prince Aegon's head against the wall. Some whisper it was done at Aerys' own command, when he learned that Lord Lannister had taken up Robert's cause, while others suggest that Ilya did it herself, for fear of what would happen to her children in the hands of her dead husband's enemies. Aerys' hand, Rossart, was killed at a postern gate after cravenly attempting to flee the castle. And last of all to die was King Aerys himself, at the hand of his remaining Kingsguard knight, Sir Jaime Lannister. Like his father, Sir Jaime did as he thought best for the realm, bringing an end to the Mad King. And so ended both the reign of House Targaryen and Robert's Rebellion, the war that put an end to nearly 300 years of Targaryen rule, and ushered in a new golden era under the auspices of House Baratheon. The Glorious Reign. Since the fall of House Targaryen, the realm has prospered greatly. Robert the First of his name took charge of a fractured Westeros and swiftly healed it of the many ills inflicted by the Mad King and his son. As his first act, the unwed king took to wife the most beautiful woman in the realm, Cersei of House Lannister, thereby granting to House Lannister all the honours that Aerys had denied it. And though all know Lord Tywin might well have become hand again, the king, in his graciousness, gave that office to his old friend and protector, Lord John Arryn, instead. The wise and just Lord Arryn has indeed helped the king shepherd the realm to prosperity since. But this is not to say that Robert's reign has been completely untroubled. 6 years after he was crowned, Balon Greyjoy unlawfully rose against his king, not for any harm done to him or to his people, but merely out of wanton ambition. Lord Stannis Baratheon, Robert's middle brother, led the royal fleet against Lord Greyjoy, while King Robert himself rode at the head of a mighty host. Great feats of arms were performed by King Robert when Pike was eventually taken and subdued. The king then made Balon Greyjoy, the pretender to the crown of the Iron Isles, bend the knee to the Iron Throne. And as assurance of his fealty, his only surviving son was taken hostage. Now the realm is at peace, and all that Robert's ascension to the throne once promised has come to pass. Our noble king has overseen one of the longest summers in many years, filled with prosperity and good harvest. Moreover, the king and his beloved queen have given the realm 3 golden heirs to ensure that House Baratheon will long reign supreme. And though a false king beyond the wall has recently declared himself, Mance Rayder is an oathbreaker, fled from the Night's Watch, and the Night's Watch has always brought swift justice to those who have betrayed it. This king will amount to nothing, as have all the other wildling kings before him. It may not always be so, as this history has shown. The world has seen many ages. Many thousands of years have passed from the Dawn Age to today. Castles have risen and fallen, as have kingdoms. Crofters have been born, grown to work the fields, and died of age or mishap or illness, leaving behind children to do the same. Princes have been born, grown to wear a crown, and died in war or bed or tourney, leaving behind reigns great, forgettable, or reviled. The world has known ice in the long night, and it has known far in the doom. From the frozen shore to Ashai by the shadow, this world of ice and fire has revealed a rich and glorious history, although there is much yet to be discovered. If more fragments of Maester Gildane's manuscript are located, or if other such incomparable treasures, at least to the Maester's eyes, are uncovered, more of our ignorance may be sponged away. But one thing can be said with certainty. As the next 1,000 years unfold, and the thousands beyond that, many more will be born and live and die. And history will continue to unfold as strange and complex and compelling as what my humble pen was able to lay before you here. No man can say with certainty what the future may hold, but perhaps in knowing what has already transpired, we can all do our part to avoid the mistakes of our forebears, to emulate their successes, and to create a world more harmonious for our children and their children, for generations to come. In the name of the glorious King Robert, first of his name, I humbly conclude this history of the Kings of the Seven Kingdoms. The Seven Kingdoms. The North. The vast and frigid realm of the Kings of Winter, the Starks of Winterfell, is generally considered the first and oldest of the Seven Kingdoms, in that it has endured unconquered for the longest. The vagaries of geography and history set the North apart from their southern neighbors.
For centuries, it has been the custom to speak of the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros. This familiar usage derives from the seven great kingdoms that held sway over most of Westeros below the Wall during years immediately preceding Aegon's conquest. Yet, even then, the term was far from exact, for one of those kingdoms was ruled by a princess rather than a king, Dorne, and Aegon Targaryen's own kingdom of Dragonstone was never included in the count. Nonetheless, the term endures, just as we speak of the Hundred Kingdoms of yore. Though there was never a time when Westeros was actually divided into 100 independent states, we must bow to common usage and talk of the Seven Kingdoms, despite the imprecision.
It is often said that the North is as large as the other 6 kingdoms put together, but the truth is somewhat less grand. The North, as ruled today by House Stark of Winterfell, comprises little more than a third of the realm. Beginning at the southern edge of the Neck, the domains of the Starks extend as far north as the New Gift, itself part of their realm, until King Jaehaerys I convinced Winterfell to cede those lands to the Night's Watch. Within the North are great forests, windswept plains, hills and valleys, rocky shores, and snow-crowned mountains. The North is a cold land, much of it rising moorlands and high plains giving way to mountains in its northern reaches, and this makes it far less fertile than the reaches of the South. Snow has been known to fall there even in summer, and it is deadly in winter. White Harbor, the North's sole true city, is the smallest city in the Seven Kingdoms. The most prominent towns in the North are the Winter Town, beneath the walls of Winterfell, and Barrowton in the Barrowlands. The former is largely empty in spring and summer, but filled to bursting in autumn and winter with those seeking the protection and patronage of Winterfell to help them survive the lean times. Not only do townsmen arrive from the outlying villages and crofts, but many a son and daughter of the mountain clans have been known to make their way to the Winter Town when the snows begin to fall in earnest. Barrowton, too, is somewhat of a curiosity, a gathering place built at the foot of the reputed Barrow of the First King, who once ruled supreme over all the First Men, if the legends can be believed. Rising from the midst of a wide and empty plain, it has prospered thanks to the shrewd stewardship of the Dustins, loyal bannermen to the Starks, who have ruled the Barrowlands in their name since the fall of